EU Special Representative for Human Rights. He became ambassador of the European Union to the United States on March 1st, 2019, and we're very pleased and honored to welcome him at the University of Wisconsin today. Please join me in warmly welcoming the ambassador. So the way that we're going to do this, we actually very much appreciate this kind of format where rather than having somebody talk for an extended period of time, we decided to have more of an interactive conversation here. And I'm going to be moderating together with Michael Keating, who I also very briefly want to introduce. He is a professor at the University of Duisburg-Essen in Germany, and he's currently the Karl Schurz Visiting Professor at UW-Madison. I'm very grateful that he agreed to be part of this. But basically, the way that we're envisioning this is that we're going to ask you some questions and kind of in a more conversational way have this event take place, and then we're going to open it up to questions in a little while. And maybe I could just start out by asking you what you're doing in Wisconsin while you're here today. All days, that's right.
I'm here because this is a huge state when it comes to both the economic relationship that it has with Europe and also the human relationship. If you look at Wisconsin, the diasporas, European, Americans of European descent living in the state are huge. The Germans are by far the biggest diaspora of others. These things connect us in a way, Europeans and Americans, that we took for granted for many years and we shouldn't be anymore. Because they also, those human relations and the trade relations, they carry with them something that is fundamental, and that's value. And values in today's world are in danger. After the Berlin Wall fell, and after there was a transition in the Eastern European countries, we kind of assumed that democracy and human rights and all these things would be fine. And they're not really fine in today's world, both because we in our own societies tend to have perhaps taken them for granted for too long and maybe are indicating the signs of fatigue with our own democracies, and that's scary as heck. We have to listen to what you guys think about this. But also because others around the world who never shared those values are becoming much more effective in exporting them. When we export, cars or, wine or whatever it is from Europe, in those containers, we don't just put our goods. We also put our values. Because that car that's produced in Europe is produced by workers whose rights are protected, not by children or by slave labor. It's produced in a way that protects the environment in the best possible way. It doesn't pollute it and destroy it and destroy the rivers and destroy the water and things like that. It's produced have it in mind that it will not be sold or go to promote repression or to promote corruption. All those values are in that container, together with that good. And those values are in your containers as well. But they're not in other containers coming out. But other countries are trying to export their own values, their own visions of human rights, of labor rights, of environmental standards, and they're very different to ours, frankly, and to our democracies. So that's why I'm here because we have to share and remember that what connects us as Europeans and Americans is both trade and investment and real life, food on the table. And I'll tell you much more about that if you're interested. But I'm also here because I want to reconnect us as people, remembering that we share values that are at stake around the world in our own societies, and we have to bind together.
When I talk to people in Wisconsin and I talk about campus that are focused on the EU. Sometimes people seem to be surprised at the depth of the trade relationships that you already mentioned. And I was just wondering if you can talk a little bit more about what the trade relationship is between the EU and Wisconsin, how important it is for the Wisconsin economy, and whether or not there are particular sectors that are critical to all of them.
Yeah, thanks, absolutely. And thank you for bringing this up. This is, if you go to EU in the US trade, EUinTheUSTrade.org. You will see for everyone and for every U.S. state something to put. We sat down and we surveyed, we did a deep dive in every state, and we saw what exactly that state gains from exporting to the European Union, having invested in it from the European Union, tourism, then breaking it down to different companies, you'll see, didn't we stop Wisconsin the major companies and where they are? And you'll see the numbers, about 90,000 jobs in this state are created by European investment here. Europe is the second biggest market for Wisconsin for exports. So all those things that you see there, from your soybeans to your aeronautics and machinery and chemicals and all these things, and fundamentally services, all of these things go to Europe after Canada more than they do anywhere else in the world. And the reason for that is that Europe is, in fact, one of the biggest free and open market in the world, by far. And the strength of the United European Union and single market is what is making it, what is making us, a booster of prosperity for every single American in every single state in the United States of America. And this is something that gets lost sometimes in the debate. You see the tweets, so the Europeans are unfair. I saw somewhere, someone said, oh, the Europeans, in fact, were created to be unfair. And they're created to save the planet from Americans, all these things. This is just simply absolutely not true. It's absolutely not true. But here's what Europe does do and can do, and why Europe is very important. This trade, the fact that so many American families and so many European families are every day blessed to have ourselves, each other, as our closest allies and biggest trading partners, is because Europe has managed to become, from its inception, a single market. Now, this sounds very Euro, a single market, oh my God, what is that? Fundamentally, it's the biggest deregulation that has ever happened in the world. Deregulation. I emphasize deregulation because one thing I hear very often is, oh, the Europeans, Europeans, bureaucracy, Brussels. It's the biggest deregulation you've ever seen. So in a sense, we took the laws and the regulations of 28 independent countries and we transferred. And in their place, we put one single set of regulations and laws, from maternity leave to labor rights to anything that governs the movement of people, of goods, of services, and of capital. And by putting, and of course that was a bureaucratic exercise. When you get rid of 28 different laws, you have to create one, you have to build that. Because of that, there are zero borders today in Europe. 27 countries, independent countries. That's even tougher than taking 50 states. Not exactly independent. Of course, okay, you had it for the Civil War, they figured this out. Other than that, fair enough. 27 independent countries in the 20th century. And they got rid of all that. What did this create? The richest, freest, most open market of 450 million of the most prosperous consumers in the world. And the most prosperous workers and producers and innovators and all those things. That is what Europe is. That for a U.S. company means that you can go and set up shop in any corner of the European Union, any corner, and you have automatic immediate access with zero tariffs, zero any other hassles to those 450 million people, no matter where they live, in those 27 countries. That is what has made European companies vote with their feet. And they go and invest in Europe. 58% of all your investments, all American investments around the world go to the European Union. Mm-hmm. Almost 60%. Not to China. I mean, to China, to whatever. Figure out another 170, 180 countries around the world, All that takes about 40% of your investments, and the European Union takes 60%. Now, that is the kind of relationship, trade relationship, that I wish to celebrate. Because it makes most of our, both of our people rich, and both of the people prosperous, and it's one that has Samaritans once in a while, but fundamentally it's entirely open. And this is where we ought to be going for. So I'm here to get the message out as well. We have Samaritans. Why don't we talk a little bit about them now or later? I mean, the Harley Davidsons and all that stuff. Other little company you guys have here, right? So it's interesting. This indicates how terrible tariff was. So tariffs are taxes. Fair enough? Can we agree on this? Tariffs are taxes. If I import something in your country and you say, okay, I'm going to impose a tariff, 25% of that thing, right? Who pays that? I don't, back in Europe. I just exported it. I'm done. The person who imports is paid 25%, which is the company that buys the product or the consumer. Very often it's a company. So most of the inputs that come from Europe to here or vice versa, from you guys to Europe, very often they're components that go into producing something bigger. That component becomes more expensive, and then the product produced in the U.S., in Wisconsin, elsewhere, becomes more expensive as well because of that. And then that company producing that product here, which tries to export it out to China or to anywhere else, has a product that costs it more. So what's it going to do now? It's either going to swallow that increase in the price of the tariff, the company itself, which means that it's going to make much less profit, or it's going to try to pass that extra cost to the consumer, the final consumer, by increasing the price of the product, and that means that the product becomes less competitive, right, compared to other products. Fundamentally, tariffs are taxes that hurt consumers and hurt businesses, and we don't want them, and neither should you. So what happened about a couple of years ago is that the U.S. government decided that it's going to protect some of its industries against international law just because it was a political decision. And one of these industries was the steel and aluminum industry. And to do so, the U.S. government said, I declare that steel and aluminum imports from any country, well, some countries in the world, are a national security threat to the United States. A national security threat. It's the only group they, you know, the government could find in order to justify such tariffs. Okay? Which in fact is protectionism, but protectionism doesn't protect. That's the trick. Because it creates this whole trade war. So what happened now? Many European companies who are entirely trading fairly with the U.S. and in fact trading very high quality steel that U.S. companies like, and they buy and they make very high quality products, and this is an absolutely fantastic relationship that benefits everyone, many EU companies get very hardly hit because of this. So the EU has to say, okay, you cannot be imposing those illegal tariffs. I have a legal right under international law to impose counterbalancing measures, they're called. So equivalent tariffs to your products. And among the products that we identified to impose more tariffs on were motorcycles from the United States, and that also includes harness, right, or gear. So you see now, it's suddenly what you have is a situation where the two biggest economies in the world, instead of reducing even further their already low tariffs, are increasing those tariffs. So instead of allowing our citizens and our workers to benefit from this trade, we're in fact making it more difficult and more expensive for our consumers and our companies to do so. And it's entirely possible to do this. You can have an upward spiral of all these things, and then economies collapse. That happened back in the 30s, in fact, and it can very possibly happen again. Or, call it a job, we just sit down and we identify why it is that this is just a mistake and decide we're going to takeoff list status, because the moment the U.S. takes off this new aluminum tariffs, that second that the U.S. takes off those tariffs that it imposed, we will take off all the counterbalancing tariffs that we impose, including on motorcycles. The second the U.S. does, we're committed to doing that. Or we can move to try to reduce both tariffs from both sides even lower. And we're ready to do that as well. We were ready, in fact, for a year and a half, to reduce the tariffs that we have on all industrial goods, cars, machines, you know, microwave ovens, whatever. Reduce them down to zero tomorrow. U.S. zero, Europe zero.
May I follow up on this maybe very quickly, and maybe head up to everyone here now participating in the audience. You will get a chance later on also to ask questions right away. So please do collect them, start thinking of questions you might want to address to the messenger directly right after. Because while talking about trade, and you were referring and explaining there are obviously also problems, and we just learned that the Trump administration will raise tariffs on European aircraft, so there is the issue that also EU companies have a subsidy for political reasons of European aircraft. So it's again a coin with two sides, right? So it's always politics involved, and you have to think and look into this, but at the same time, I think with a very strong making the point of lowering basically the tariff to zero. So how likely do you think will it be in the next coming months or years to actually look into the idea of a new free trade agreement between the US and the EU?
I think the likelihood of an agreement that covers everything is small. Not because there are no great arguments about having it, but because there's some products and topics on both sides that are very politically sensitive to put on the table. So it might be easier to just find the points of agreement, the so-called low-hanging fruit that exists, and try to build on that than after, right? So, and I'm very much hoping that we may be able to do this. We're working with the new president of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, and President Trump met in Davos on the 21st of January, and they had that discussion, and everyone's working very hard since then. But I think, if I may, use your question to jump to, connect it to another issue. So I don't want to give you guys a false impression now, but about, so not everything is cloud-free in trade relationships anywhere in the world, and that also includes the EU and the US. There are some areas of contention and friction. I mentioned that we cannot have a full agreement immediately because we both have issues. So, the U.S. side has some issues with some of the cultural goods and what it claims are unfair barriers that Europe has to the trade of some of those goods. An example given sometimes is chemically treated chickens, which is the way that you actually do chicken in the States, more or less. You just raise the chicken in a very particular way that perhaps accumulates a number of impurities and diseases and stuff like that, and we know that that gets the chicken perhaps fat much faster, and then when all that is over, you chemically treat the chicken to kill whatever it has been accumulated, let's say, and then to export it, and you say that, you know, scientifically speaking, the chicken is entirely healthy when it leaves, and in Europe, we say no, I mean, according to our consumers' demands and preferences, and Europeans are very and they show that in every election, very insistent on ensuring that there's food quality and food safety. We say no, I mean, people don't want to have that kind of thing. And also, by the way, we don't raise, our farmers don't raise chickens this way, and if you allow, you know, massively, you know, raised and treated cheap, quote-unquote, you know, mass-scale chicken come in, that kills the quality of life and the sustenance of many, many people who don't want to do it this way. But the U.S. is complaining about this, right? And they have U.S. farmers to complain. Now, the part of all our trade that is that is a joke. It's very, very small. That's politically sensitive. We have politically sensitive issues as well. The Buy America that exists in this country. So every and any U.S. company can go and bid in Europe, in any European country, in any European city, if there is a public procurement part. So I'm building a road in Hamburg. Who wants to bid for that road? I do. Any U.S. company can say. And I can do it better and cheaper than any EU company. You can come and you can bid, and if you win that bid, no questions asked. You don't have to have a certain percentage of European steel in the roads that you use. You don't have to have a certain, you don't have to be a European company. Somewhere you just do it. In the States, our companies can. So you have obligations for any company coming here to have to buy American sourced material to be more expensive than the ones that you might find in Europe. All those things, by the way, make what you produce here much more expensive for the taxpayer in any particular state. Because you don't open up your competition enough. By definition, you don't allow others to come in who might have a better, cheaper deal to give you. You may charge that it's too cheap and it's not, the quality is not good, but you don't have it. So that's a thing that the European companies ask for. You come in and answer, wait a second, every sovereign government has a right to decide, to support its own domestic industry, and no one under international law says that we couldn't have made that decision when we made it, and we made it, that's okay. Out of contention. Fair enough. Again, perhaps a bigger part for us than the chicken we do, but very politically sensitive. But take, if I've done the trade and the values, take Airbus and Boeing, and then think of China. Very simple. Airbus was subsidized by some European governments, so said the tribunal of the World Trade Organization. But the same organization, in a different trial, found that Boeing was also being subsidized in different ways by the state of Washington and by NASA and others. Okay? So, in a sense, we're both sinners. We're both bound to have violated international rules. So, what do you do in those cases? Well, in this case, you have a legal right to impose tariffs on each other to counterbalance the violation that was found. Except we both were found to be violating. So doesn't it make sense, instead of saying, okay, let's just start beating each other on the head and forever on this, let's just sit down instead and settle the case and see how we can settle it in an effective way. An effective way is also looking at what in the future subsidies in the aircraft industry might be legal and what might be entirely illegal. And once we decide this among ourselves, then we can turn around and try to let the rest of the world know what the rules of the game are. Why is this important? Because as we speak, China is building a 100% state-subsidized aircraft. They're not embarrassed about rules and games, they're doing it. And in 10, 15 years, that airplane is certified. People expect it may take that long, but eventually it will be. Would be flooding, first of all, the Chinese market, to which both Airbus and Boeing are selling 30% of the new aircraft today. They would be dramatically hit. That's a national security threat. If our two biggest airline manufacturers have a real problem of survivability. So why are we not sitting down and negotiating instead of reimposing tariffs on each other? That's a big strategic mistake. And we hope to be able to convince the U.S. side to come to the table.
So is this something that, we kind of have new leadership now in Europe, right? We have a new commission under Ursula von der Leyen, who you mentioned. We also have, newly composed European Parliament. Are those some of the priorities on the European side? Or perhaps more generally, what are the priorities, or what do you expect are going to be the things that are going to be highlighted or emphasized now in this new kind of time period that we entered after the elections last year?
Good. So one priority is clearly trade economy. The second priority is European green growth. The third priority is
digital future. The fourth priority is a fair economy for all. And then there are a number of other priorities, of course, including right, immigration and all these things, right? So trade is a big difference between us and you. In the past, well, 5 years, diverse clearly, but today we have free trade agreements the Europeans do with 72 countries all over the world. That's almost one third of all countries, more than one third of all countries in the world. And some of the biggest ones. You have only 16. We are opening up a market even more. We're open for business. But because we are a very big market, the biggest market, we have those agreements, they are always win-win. Both sides win, but we are also able to ask for things that are very important for free trade. So, for example, we put a great emphasis in our agreements in saying to people, other countries, if you're going to be trading with us, if we're going to give you 0%, say, tariff of the goods to come to Europe, I mean, that's a big concession because it actually could risk the jobs of some Europeans and others, you know, lose some jobs, make some jobs somewhere else. And in Europe to put more emphasis in protecting those who are left behind, and maybe you guys are doing here in the States. But if we're going to give the sanctions, then you're going to be doing some things. You cannot be violating human rights. So if you look at human rights clauses, now there are non-trade agreements. You cannot be violating privacy rights. So if we're talking about trading in services and exchanging data, which is the new, say, you know, oil, century, that data has to be protected. It cannot be, you know, easily stolen or abused by other companies or governments or others. So we can put the rules of the game in place around the world because we're out there making these agreements. And the U.S., as I said, is not. We wish that the U.S. would, instead of closing its borders more, opening like we do, because that's certainly, we found that's in our interest. Second thing, environment. Okay, so climate change in Europe is not the politically sensitive or divisive topic that it is for you guys here. It's not a right-left thing. There's not a single person, not a single European citizen who didn't demand in the last European election strong development commission for that commission to make addressing climate change one of the priorities. That goes, like I said, throughout gender, political belief, everything. And the reason is A, because climate change actually is happening, it's on hold. And B, because addressing it immediately both has a really good chance of reversing the real dangers, and it can make us very rich eventually, because all the future growth and innovation, all the new economy, all the uses of artificial intelligence, all those things, create a humongous growth boost to those who are at the forefront of developing that economy. To give you a very simple European example, from 1990 to today, we have reduced our carbon emissions by 23%. We have increased our GDP growth by 63%. Reduce emissions, explode growth. And that was even before all these technologies have come to an economies of scale, sort of cheap situation. So not only just working in alternative energy, all these things, green energies, all that stuff, not only is that not killing European competitors, but the tax is increasing. So we know what we're doing. And I'm guessing you know what you're doing. Obviously, those two things are not jiving right now. And frankly, I would hope that they did, because the European Union, at the end of the day, cannot really stop climate change and protect the planet on our own. We are only 9% of all the emissions in the world. The U.S. is the second biggest polluter by far in the world. China is the first biggest. Canada is not far behind, or Australia. And we need all these countries in, and unfortunately, only the U.S. has announced. agreement, that's what brought the past agreement. So we hope this is reversible, and we hope that we can work with states at state level, such as here in Wisconsin. And the governor, for example, has announced a committee to try to achieve carbon neutrality by 2050, which is exactly our goal in Europe as well. And there's a tremendous amount of work that can be done between our administrators, between our companies, between our universities to make this happen and look for now the other variants as well as these are
that
will
allow us to move on maybe with another topic, because we want to tackle as many as possible. The list is long. We just make a short selection and then move on to you to get ready for the questions, right? So one lady of the market to be right here, writing is the issue of populism. Populism is an issue that has kept us busy in Europe, amongst others. Eurocepticism is a big topic. We have issues of rule of law with some of the EU member states in the European Union. Something in the form of the capacity that you have within the EU about. Something you have been involved and actively engaged in. So how do you think will Europe deal in the near future with issues of populism and Eurocepticism? Is there a recipe that we hear about? Because we know after the European elections we have the fourth biggest party group of the European Parliament, the Eurosceptic party group. We have member states with participation of populist and Eurosceptic parties in government and strong opposition.
First of all, I would like to define populism. I think it's a populism that I find dangerous. If you're frankly politicians, and I'm a politician myself, as you heard before, tend to be populist anyway. I'm being populist right now with you in some way. What I mean by this is I'm trying to use language that is understandable, that is popular, and that can excite you as well as just make you think. If you're trying to do your job right, you're doing this, but that's not populism. Dangerous populism is one that, in my view at least, is one that tries to ascribe to a single individual, a strong man in the EU, could be a strong woman, but we don't see the profile of he's advocating that kind of rhetoric. That tries to ascribe to one person all the attributes of representing the people, and tries to therefore dismantle or badmouth every checks and balances institution in that democratic system that might claim that they also have the right to represent and to balance the power of that one person, because that one person, the field that goes, is the real protector of the people, that person, right? No one else. And the problem is, in my view at least, that in a democracy, I do when you look at democracy, define where it is, fundamentally it is its checks and balances. I mean, that's what our democracies have never been institutional structures in which the winner takes all. In fact, Western democracies have been the exact opposite. Institutional structures that ensure that the winner does not take all. That those who lose, the minorities in any society, have the right to be protected and to be governed by whoever wins, as much as the people who were in the majority. That a recognition that even the most democratic elected persons can split. And therefore there's a requirement to have strong independent judiciary that can judge whether or not the executive power, the government, has overstepped the bounds. A strong press, free press, has any opinion in favor or against, but has the absolute right to do so. Respected for its effort for doing so, and of course, a strong, independent, and free thinking legislation on all things. Now, the legislature, judiciary, administration, government, those are the three pillars in any democracy, right? The press
and balance. Right? If you're a government, you don't have to agree with any NGO coming to your office and telling you that you're terrible. And referring to human rights, I assure you that most of the time, the big human rights NGOs would not come to me and thank me for the wonderful work I was doing. They usually come in and tell me that, you know, all the things that I could do better. I wasn't doing better, and sometimes they were right, sometimes they were wrong in my view, but I didn't have to follow any advice. But at least in democracy, you allow the freedom of people to keep your feet on the cold. So populism, the real danger, is when you come and you try to undermine all these institutions, right? Two, in Europe, the European Parliament and the European Commission have felt in the past few years that there are two countries in Europe in which there's a real danger that their governments are doing exactly that. So they're not going against populists. They are looking at things like rule of law, freedom of academic expression, all those things that are enshrined, let's say, in the European treaties. And there's a process of the European treaties that the Parliament or the European Commission can say, can trigger a process against countries that appear to be at their real risk of violating fundamental European values. Those two countries were Hungary and Poland, okay? And in both cases, it has to do with what the Commission and the Parliament determined were real fundamental risks to the judiciary, to civil society, to academic freedoms, press freedoms, etc. That's a process. In both cases, it's ongoing. But I mentioned this to you to underline the resilience and the strength of the European Union democracy. By the way, the European Court of Justice has gotten involved in some of these cases and made some decisions on them. And to their credit, both these countries have actually applied them to their decisions. I mentioned this because this is very important. You have a real crisis. If an executive starts saying, oh, who cares about, you know, the courts? I don't care. But then you see that, but then it's always a battle. Okay, we accept that decision and then we'll do something else this way or that. I am proud of the European Union because of this process, and I am proud because it took place and it happened at the exact time that Brexit was taking place. And everyone was telling, European leaders, don't be foolish. You know, European rabble, the Brits are leaving. People are very unhappy in so many member states for all these reasons. And now you're going to start attacking two other member states and saying that they're bad. They will leave tomorrow. You're over. Stop it. And what we said was, no, wait a second. We are nothing other than the sum of the values upon which we were actually created. We didn't just use those values as, they meant to us. We came out of the Second World War when we slaughtered each other, Europeans did. When we had the Holocaust, the biggest human rights violation in history. And we said this will never happen again. Not in our hands. And we will form the biggest, freest, most respectful of rights union ever. And we will actually also create at the same time the biggest, freest, most prosperous economy in the world. And we set up doing both. It wasn't about the money, it wasn't about the values, it was about both. But it was fundamentally about never again getting to the point that we would do that kind of slaughter. And so that is important to us. It means something. And we decided we're going to take action for things that, if you were to look at the United States of America today, you might wonder, are similar things happening here? Are there not? I don't know. It's an interesting big discussion. But we used our constitution back in Europe, or our treaties back in Europe, to take action, and we did. And here's what happened. Both of these countries and everyone else is in the European Union. In the European Parliament elections back in May 19, as you very correctly said, not only did the populist anti-European feeling not take over, but in fact, it didn't. 10% more people came out to vote in a 2019 election that they had the past two or three elections. More people came out. And those people, the majority of them, actually voted for the pro-European parties. So not only did populism not reach a critical mass around Europe that would overtake Europe, but there was a tipping point where European citizens said, this is becoming real dangerous, and no, we're not going to sit on our couch, no, we're not going to feel afraid, no, we're not going to feel desperate or useless, but we're actually going to go out and cast our vote for Europe. And it worked. And then you look at every single European member state, between seven member states, you look at the support of the European Union having gone up or way up in the past 3 years in the midst of Brexit and in the midst of this. So am I concerned about populism in Europe? You betcha. Am I panicking and throwing my hands up and going, oh my God, we're going to be overtaken? No. Absolutely not. But if you were to ask me, give us the magic formula, Mr. Lambridis, because we want to be able to just do the same thing. You know, in so many different parts of the world, I don't know.
I try. It's good.
Okay, let's open it up. We have about 15 minutes left. So I would like, given that we're in a university, I would like to favor students here. So I would like to take student questions primarily. I also would like to make sure that there's a gender balance in those. So I'll open it up. There's a mic. I don't know if you want to maybe.
Can I ask you to raise your hand if you are not Americans, if you're a foreign student? Okay. So the rest of you are Americans. Can you raise your hands if you are not from Wisconsin? Okay. From Wisconsin? All right. They say Wisconsin kind of wins it. America is not from Wisconsin, a close second. Foreigners, very respectful first. All right, thanks.
Okay. If you want to raise your hand, then I'm going to take student questions primarily, sorry. Okay, so we have one over here.
In your opinions, do you think Brexit will affect the Wisconsin's trade with the EU in any way?
It's a very good question. I'm sure I don't have the answer because I don't have the cyber data. What you saw up there, this, for example, was done before Brexit. Mm-hmm. Now, it will not affect trade with you. Unless the UK economy suffers at some point, if the Brexit negotiations don't go well, in which case it probably will suffer quite a bit, and that may affect some of the UK investments in this country or its ability to import Wisconsin goods. But if everything goes smoothly, then you will not be exporting that particular chunk of cheese, let's say, to the EU anymore. You'll be exporting it to a third country, which is the UK. But you will still be exporting, right? So in that sense, you will not. Now, where you might be negatively hurt is the following. If there are Wisconsin companies that up to now exported only to the UK, in order for then those exports to be taken to the rest of the EU, as I said before, the strength of the single market is that you set up shop anywhere and then 450 million consumers can have your products. And many companies, they like London, you know, it was kind of fun or something else, they say, okay, I just set up shop in London or in the UK, and then I will just sell my cheese to Greece and to Italy and to Poland. Now they will not be able to do this. So unless they have changed their business model and made sort of a country in the European Union their entryway, there may be an issue if the UK does what it says. Some say they want to do it. Diverge from the EU rules, then there will be tariffs and other problems getting goods from the UK to the EU, and that would also affect those efforts. Okay, but that's basically.
Can I ask one more question?
I would like other people to be able to ask questions, but thank you. I
Thank you. Just one quick question. How do you foresee the EU's relationship with Turkey proceeding over the next few years?
It's a tough one. That's a really tough one, because Turkey is a candidate country. So we decided 2 years back that Turkey would be a candidate to become a full EU member state. And to do that, you need to do many things. You need to change your... In a sense, you need to start adjusting all your laws to become the same as the EU's, which is exactly what every other country in the EU had to do to get into the EU. You have to change your economic laws little by little in order to create the single market. So by the time you enter, you don't have different labor standards than the rest of the EU. You don't write all that. But you also have to adjust your values. So you need all the laws that have to do with human rights, with independence of judiciary, all those things. You also need to change those, right? So Turkey started this process in a very enthusiastic way and actually made quite a bit of progress through a number of governments, including Erdogan's in the early 2000s. And then there was a very clear both fatigue, reform fatigue, let's say, in Turkey itself, but also a different political direction, perhaps away from the EU and towards more of the philosophy of becoming sort of a Muslim democratic leadership country in the rest of the Muslim world and the rest of the region. And that divergence cost Turkey a lot in terms of the reforms. In fact, in the past few years, you've seen many of the reforms going back, in terms of democracy, treatment of journalists and others. There also was, however, another process taking place in the EU itself, which expanded with 10 new member states back in 2003, which was the process of actually enlarging the EU, enlarging itself with new countries, and recognizing that even if you manage to align your laws, it is actually a very difficult process, because you really need to live by live, not just the laws, it's also the mentalities, it's also, you know, managing to find your place as an economy in a unified Europe. And all those things, turns out, are not always easy and always automatic. So then there started to be a concern by some EU member states about further enlargements or too quick enlargements. That was the discussion happening in Europe. Well, shouldn't we go deep first before we go wide again? Thing. Should we try to have more alignment in all these things before we started bringing these new countries in? So, in a sense, a perfect storm was created around those two things that were kind of diverging to the profit of Turkey's coming in. Turkey's backsliding and great reduction in desire to become a European member state country, at least as perceived by us, and European concern about ensuring that our enlargements do not take place faster than we're able to absorb the countries. Where are we now? We're now in a place where Turkey is a country that is very close to Europe, with which we insist on the enlargement process. We want Turkey to become a European Union country when the conditions are met. We do not want Turkey to diverge. So we constantly, you know, are working with Turkey, sometimes in frustrating circumstances, because it doesn't want to make the changes that EU laws, special Turkey, EU laws apply. But we engage. We want Turkey to remain tied to a democratic process and not slide back. And in all these things, and we also want Turkey to be a force of peace in the region and not instability. And Turkey has, in our view, in a very unwise way, created greater stability now, including with Cyprus, a European member state, of course, whose territorial waters and sovereignty Turkey has been attacking for decades. In fact, it occupies the Turkish army remarkably, or still occupies half of Cyprus, which is an EU member state, and refuses to leave. But now you have also heightened tensions in the Aegean that relate to energy routes and all those things that are quite important, generally speaking, but not for now, perhaps. So our strategy is to keep Turkey tied firmly to the European perspective of membership, to continue working very closely with Turkey on all the many issues in the region where Turkey can have a voice and a positive one if it chooses to have one, whether it's Syria or Iraq or Libya or energy or anything else. And to hope and expect that we as Europeans will be comfortable with our debate on the process necessary to enlarge our union, so that when Turkey is ready, we are ready as well.
Let's see if we have all
Do you anticipate any policy change with regards to the euro, given the financial problems it has caused for smaller EU countries?
Well, the euro is saying, thank you. Never say never, and of course, in fact, I always anticipate changes when it comes to the way that the European Central Bank is. The euro is something that is dealt by the European Central Bank in the same way that the dollar is dealt by your Fed. It's not something that European governments make decisions on directly, right? The euro is, after the dollar, the biggest reserve currency in the world. In the financial crises, people thought that it might collapse. Greece at the time I was foreign minister of Greece, and I would have to explain to people, including the states, that no, Greece is not going to leave Europe, it's not going to collapse, the euro is not going to collapse. Everyone was looking at me, basically feeling sorry for me for not having seen the future that was coming. And of course, I'm kind of happy I was right and then wrong, right? But it's an extremely strong currency. If you look at the financial crisis, it fundamentally hit the euro. You see the euro lost a little bit, gained a little bit. It's where it was, in fact, even stronger today than it used to be. So no, I'm not at all concerned about that. What you may see changing is policies of the European Central Bank and policies of the European Union Council, the Member States and the Commission, to create more monetary and fiscal space in Europe, as it were. So what does that mean? The financial crisis hit here in 2007-8. The administration around 2009, if I'm not mistaken, 2010, had a huge fiscal stimulus that came in, right? In Europe, we didn't. So governments did not invest more money into the economy at the time of the financial crisis. We instead invested more in ensuring that we could have fiscal consolidation, so ensure that European member states were not exceeding by too much the debt and deficit and all those things that are important to consolidate fiscal. So we didn't continue to spend much money on the issue, let's say. Okay? That's a contractionary policy, fiscal policy. So at the time that there was a recession, we also did a contractionary fiscal policy. At the time there was a recession, you did a fiscally expansionary policy, right? So it was a different process. We managed to consolidate our finances in some countries like Greece and Ireland and others that were caught in that storm, although they were not necessarily the cause of the storm. Caught in the storm of a very strong euro, which however did not have around it a strong political union and a strong economic union, but at least it had a strong monetary union, and that was created sort of black holes in our system that were exploited for the crisis. We managed to sort of ensure that we built a fortress around those things. We're not there yet, entirely, but the next crisis will not really hit us this way, right? It would be much easier for us. So that's the fiscal element, that's the monetary element. But then the fiscal element that we have to face is, do we, now that we're out of the woods of the monetary crisis, do we now invest more? So do we have this fiscal expansion in the way that you did? And then you have the other stimulus with the tax cuts that we have now under this administration. So I think that's what we will see more being discussed. Should Europe now use surpluses that it has in order to invest in green growth, for example, ensure that it allows its member states to be able to even run some deficits if it will be investing in productive green growth activities? That's the discussion we see.
Okay, I think we have time for one more short question. I think we have not taken questions from this side, so maybe you can see if there's more over here. Sorry, we can't take all of the questions. I apologize.
Thank you for coming.
Can you say the way this is a beautiful room? It's always talking to wonderful people, but I didn't realize you could actually walk on board.
Well, thank you for coming and speaking with us today. Earlier you talked about, you gave a metaphor of values being exported with goods from foreign countries. And with that, it comes the state of China, and it comes to mind that as they're one of the largest, if not the largest exporter, and with that, they'd be exporting their, a lot of anti-democratic values as well. What relationship do you think that the U.S. and EU can have in the future to kind of counterbalance that or, you know, check the spread of Chinese ideals in the process?
Thank you. I would say two things very quickly on that. The first thing is, let's look at the immediate future challenge, which is artificial intelligence and where this will go. This is going to be our lives in the next many decades. And somebody has to be setting the standards for ethical use of AI. We cannot afford anymore to assume that any technology that is being created is going to be for good. We see what the internet has been, allowed an explosion of democracy, and also it has allowed an explosion of anti-democracy, and that's not okay. So artificial intelligence is a classic case, and I would say that the EU and the US have to work together to set the standards on AI. And because others have, China is doing this today. So if you go to Xinjiang, a region in China where a Muslim population called the Uyghurs is living, you will see that there are thousands of cameras in the street, facial recognition, movement recognition, that identify people, that look at the movements and tell them if they are angry or sad or aggressive, potentially, or whatever. It is hair-raising. In order to impress them with something they believe in, always under the guise of anti-counterterrorism, right? Because they're learning from us. I mean, how to use those terms to repress in their case. Okay? So this is happening as we speak, and someone's going to be setting the standards for artificial intelligence, and either it's going to be ethical and human-centered, or it's going to take over the world in a very scary way. The U.S. and EU share the same values in this particular debate are the number one prioritizing issue, so I'd say that we're good. Second, when it comes to trade and investment, Belt and Road. China right now has what's called the Belt and Road Initiative that is fundamentally amassing huge amounts of cheap cash from its central banks and others, which it controls, to finance infrastructure projects in many different countries around the world. And the problem with that is, because it is exporting its values together with its goods, is that corruption, virtually extremely low labor standards, extremely low environmental standards, all these things are being exported together with the actual investment. And in some instances, also the investment is getting used in order to create debt chokes around countries and then take as collateral a rare earth mine or a port or something like that, okay? So this is serious business. Now, the European Union and the United States together are much bigger development aid donors around the world, and development aid actually today builds roads and schools and hospitals and stuff like that, and much bigger foreign direct investment exporters than China is. But alone, each of us, enough. So you're asking me, what else? We have to find a way to ensure that we can determine, because increasingly countries and people in Africa or Latin America and investments increasingly are, in some instances, are very grateful. And they should be. Not every Chinese investment in the road is a bad investment. Right? But in those cases, we don't have the procedures in place to be able to bid with a really low, unfair bidder, which is China. And in other instances, where the investment is not okay, where the investment has ulterior motives, we have not managed yet to identify where around the world those investments that absolutely must not fall into foreign hands are, and how it is that we can bid better together to protect them. So that's more geostrategic. So if you like, these are the two areas that I would say more than anything else, and that's the Chinese question. I would focus on. We can take one more question, suppose or not, as I tell you.
No, if you want to take one more question, we can take one more question.
in the front here we have a
I was wondering, do you think the EU will ever come to a consensus or will make an agreement on how to deal with the global refugee crisis, and what you think the U.S. can do to help with the burden?
The global refugee crisis?
Yeah.
I think, obviously, that we have to address the root causes of the crises, the different crises, and pretty much know what they usually are. They're either wars, or extreme poverty, or increasing climate change. These are the three biggest drivers of people living the places in which they are and trying to, right? And that would be forced to live, to be in the places in which they are, right? Now, under international law, a refugee is one that fundamentally risks, because of the first reason, war, right? There are also cases of extraordinary protection you give to refugees. People, if you're not an expert at this, you're not supposed to know this, but you tend to throw everything together, refugees, economic migrants, others, they're not. And in fact, they have different rights under international law. So if I escape, you know, the imminent threat to my life, or my liberty, I can be a, I can apply for refugee status and receive it, right? Asylum seeker. But if I leave my country because I just want to have a better life somewhere else in America and Europe and elsewhere, I don't have a right, as a refugee would have if judged to be a legitimate refugee. I don't have a right to live or to enter that country. It is in the and the ability of the country's government and people themselves to decide who to allow in for economic reasons. And this doesn't mean that we don't take people in, right? If you go into a xenophobic state of mind, and suddenly say, I don't want anyone, if you don't, then you take people in. And, you know, that's what the United States, in fact, was the biggest country that took in people, not just the, those who deserved asylum, but the poor, the best people around the world. That's what made this country great. That's what inspired many, the rest of us to do the same. Now, because that's about refugees, however, but I'm expanding it, addressing causes of war, addressing causes of extreme poverty, addressing causes of climate change, and climate institutions, especially of areas and people and close to the water, are fundamental. So that's what we're doing as Europeans. We are focusing a lot of our attention on growth in Africa, because Africa, in fact, is a continent that it could explode in growth. It would be the next one to do so. But real growth in Africa is not going to come if the Africans today just go and try to grow themselves through 19th century businesses. It's not coming if they go through 21st century businesses. It can really leapfrog. So look at the entry of Africa and how do we get jobs. That's something to focus on. We're doing it because Africa is our neighbor. We're doing it because if there are African market expands so dramatically, also that would be good for us. We would have a much bigger market to be able to work with, export, import from, and all these things. But we're also doing it because Africa is also exploding demographically. So there are billions of people added into Africa, and if the economy in Africa is unable to absorb those people, they will try to leave. And where do they think they can actually go? Now, the problem with Europe is that Europe has the need, even though some of our people back in Europe will not recognize this, because they are suddenly very afraid of anything foreign, like they have people in America the same way. In fact, our demographic, the rate in which we make babies is falling. Okay? We don't make as many babies, for whatever reason. And our economy will probably have a tremendous need for new labor, that we're not going to be producing. So every economy basically around the world needs new labor, in addition to what it should need, which is an infusion of new cultures, ideas, all that stuff. this doesn't mean kumbaya, guys. This doesn't mean that I just take anyone in and it's all okay. It's not. There's got to be a process of integration. I mean, I am Europe. I was built on some values. It's not okay for you to come in just because, you know, you're a foreigner and you come and you don't share any of these values, or you come in and you say you have to accept my values. No, it doesn't work. Okay? But what it does work is to understand and to realize there's a tremendous necessity and benefit from reason and control when it comes to integration, where you don't look at the other person as a threat, but you look at them as a unique opportunity to integrate in your own society, accept fundamental values, and also infuse your society with the strength of the different. I came to this country, you probably can tell from my accent, it's not that Greek, I suppose, it's more American. Some of this, maybe not, but I mean, I came here as a young Greek to study. You know, this country opened, it's hospitality to me, it's universities there. I want to think that I brought to the universities I went to and the jobs I had a perspective that was extremely helpful to other people who got to know me and worked with me. I can tell you for a fact that I got a perspective from being an American and working with Americans that enriched my thinking and my life and my effectiveness and my culture and the richness that I feel for, you know, walking on this earth. This place gave me all that as well. It would have never happened to me, and maybe not to friends of mine who I'm going to touch a little bit myself. It would have never happened if we're just shutting our ship in ourselves. It's just not okay. Okay? And that, like I said, doesn't mean, oh, we open up all the borders and we all form together, okay? No. But it means we get rid of the racism and the xenophobia. It's not okay. We try to integrate people who we already have with us. We're not going to be kicking anyone out, so we've got to make sure that we do so. We've got to make sure that we economically try to help in any way we can to motivate and to strengthen other countries so that the need that makes them feel that they have to leave those countries dissipates. And frankly, we have to be much better peacemakers than countries wrecking havoc around the world. So we have to be building peace as well and thinking of the consequences of what we do as well. What's happening now in Syria with the most latest bombardments of Russia and Assad and what Turkey was doing before is creating hundreds of thousands, if that were ever possible, given how many people have already left the country, hundreds of thousands of new desperate refugees leaving. Where are they going to go? So that's not okay. It's just not okay. And the fact that we're not really discussing those things, well, because they're not, you know, I don't know about what's the expression, bread and butter issues or what have you. I mean, you know what? You know, some places in the world going to hell are going to be becoming pretty much bread and butter for all of us in a few years' time. In addition to the fact that it's not okay as a human being to be treating anyone who's not in your tribe as someone who can be killed with a human being, it doesn't matter.